It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite who took part in the Freedom Rides of the Civil Rights era. First, the Trump administration announced this week that it will levy tariffs on steel and aluminum from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. At midnight, the U.S. government instated a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports. Canada and the EU were swift in their retaliation, putting in place tariffs of their own against U.S. exports. Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
We've talked about this before when these tariffs were first previewed and then postponed. What is the reasoning that the Trump administration has given for these steel and aluminum tariffs?
Yes. So the reasoning is, ironically, it's about national security, right? And the irony is that they're targeted 98% of these tariffs to our main allies, Canada, Mexico, the EU, South Korea. Congress for decades has delegated a lot of trade policy, extensive trade policy, to the president. And this is all under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which gives the president broad authority to impose tariffs and other forms of protection in cases where there is a risk to American national security. And that's a really wide loophole, right? There's also one of the Article 21 of the GATT World Trade Organization agreements, the sort of multilateral trade body, also allows an opt-out for national security. And this is something that's been used very, very rarely because it's a huge loophole, right? If you can invoke national security for trade protection, then you can pretty much do anything. But the justification is that there's a flood of steel and aluminum coming in and that that's a risk to American national security.
The reality is it seems like this is a trade measure, not a national security measure. The idea is this will help protect American steel and aluminum producers from foreign competition. Does it do that? Is this going to help the steel industry, the aluminum industry in America?
Probably not in overall, right? I mean, the problem is, and it's one of the things we've spoken about before, is most supply chains are global now. Most American manufacturers are both importers and exporters. And so there might be some jobs that are saved. The numbers I've seen in the last 24 hours are that there's going to be a net of between 200,000 and 600,000 jobs lost, and actually a hit to the steel sector. You're raising prices, right? 10 to 25% on steel and aluminum, which are major inputs. So even if that would increase domestic steel production, it's going to make it much more expensive for manufacturers to consume steel, right? And so the demand for steel is going to go down in the United States. And the net effect then on employment and production in the steel sector and aluminum sector itself, it's unclear.
Let's look downstream now at the companies that use steel and aluminum. A lot of companies weighing in on this, worried about costs. To pick one example, Harley-Davidson, obviously a strong Wisconsin connection, saying, we use these things. This is going to raise our input costs.
Yeah. So there's the direct, right? The input costs are going to go up, and that's going to increase the cost of production. We're going to have to raise prices on our products. Demand is going to go down. The indirect worry is there's going to be retaliation, right? So the other reason Harley-Davidson is worried and American whiskey producers are worried is the Canadians and the European Union now are saying, right, these tariffs are illegal, right? These tariffs are not about national security. And in order to get the U.S. to back down, we're going to match them with retaliatory tariffs. And that's going to hurt overseas sales.
Can you talk a little more about what kind of responses we're seeing from Canada, Mexico, the European Union when it comes to tariffs in response?
Yeah. So, first thing is to think about these are our largest trading partners, right? So we have $700 billion or $720 billion in trade with the EU, Mexico and Canada. It's over a trillion. We trade more with them than we do with China, right? And what we're talking about, the Canadians said, Chrystia Freeland, who's the foreign minister yesterday, said that there's going to be $12.8 billion in retaliatory tariffs on U.S. imports into Canada. I believe the number in the European case that the European Trade Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, said there's going to be about $7.5 billion. And they're targeted to be politically sensitive, right? So you're going to try and hit Harley-Davidson or whiskey producers in Kentucky because maybe these are politically sensitive sectors that are going to lobby the Trump administration to back down.
But these things are going to have similar effects on those countries, right? The tariffs will raise costs for them. It seems like a trade war is we stand, look at each other and shoot ourselves in the foot and see who bleeds faster.
Yeah, so the, you know, the line that Trump had is trade wars are good and easy to win, right? And what history tells us is that trade wars are bad, and you get into this downward spiral of retaliatory tariffs. What does that do? It raises cost of production for producers in both countries. It raises the prices of goods for consumers. And in the end, it's not clear. And, you know, the thing with trade is, with free trade, there are distributional consequences. There are some sectors and firms that are going to win and lose. But overall, everybody benefits from trade. And so we're basically playing that game in reverse, where American consumers are going to lose, European consumers are going to lose, and the manufacturers that are both exporters and importers on both sides of the border are also going to lose.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison about the tariffs just went into effect on steel and aluminum from places like Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. I want to key in on Canada now and give a listen to Justin Trudeau up in Canada saying the Canadian government doesn't blame the American people for the actions of the administration. Here's a little bit of what he said about our relationship.
From the beaches of Normandy to the mountains of Afghanistan, we have fought and died together. Canadian personnel are serving alongside Americans at this very moment. We are partners in NORAD, NATO, and around the world. We came to America's aid after 9/11, as Americans have come to our aid in the past, and we're fighting together against Daesh in northern Iraq. The numbers are clear. The United States has a $2 billion U.S. dollar surplus in steel trade with Canada. And Canada buys more American steel than any other country in the world. Indeed, we account for half of U.S. exports, U.S. steel exports. Canada is a secure supplier of aluminum and steel to the U.S. defense industry, putting aluminum in American planes and steel in American tanks. That Canada could be considered a national security threat to the United States is inconceivable.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau there. A lot there, Mark. What do you take away from that?
Yeah, I mean, it is inconceivable. I mean, in terms of our relationship with Canada, trade, security, they are probably our closest ally. And the difficulty for them is we are their largest trading partner. They are, a small country relative to us and very dependent on trade in a way that we trade a lot with the EU and China and other countries. We're not as dependent. But the bilateral relationship, I mean, it's the closest geopolitical and economic relationship we have. It's the longest undefended border in the world, essentially. It's very clear that there is a political story behind the tariffs, and it's not about national security.
And he mentioned there the U.S. actually has a trade surplus when it comes to steel with Canada. Also, according to the way the American government calculates it, we have a trade surplus with Canada, not a deficit. The Canadians find a little bit different, but it's close either way you slice it.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you measure it. If you factor in only goods, if you factor in services, the two economies are so deeply enmeshed, not just in imports and exports, but again, in terms of cross-border value chains of production, right? I mean, since we've had NAFTA in the 1990s, the American auto industry has reoriented its production, right, to be producing simultaneously in Mexico, Canada, and the United States. And more or less, we're talking about one economy in the 21st century. And so, the idea that this is about national security and that we're targeting China, what we're seeing is these are our largest trading partners. These are also our NATO allies. I mean, the central military alliance we have since the 1940s is with the Western European countries and Canada. And as Trudeau was talking about, right, the military equipment that is at the heart of that alliance uses steel from Canada, from Germany, from the United States. So there are real geopolitical consequences. But I also think you hear in his tone, we've been fighting trade disputes with Canada for decades, right? But they're sort of friendly trade disputes and they go on and we resolve them through NAFTA, through the WTO. The tone that you hear with Trudeau and with Chrystia Freeland now, it's a very different tone of, we're not getting anywhere with these negotiations, and we really need to kind of take action now.
Yeah, let's talk more about NAFTA, because part of the deal with delaying these tariffs initially was, hey, let's see if we can get, we, the United States, can get the deal we want with Canada and Mexico and NAFTA, and then maybe we can take these off the table. Prime Minister Trudeau said that he was working on having a meeting with President Trump. He heard from, he says, Vice President Pence saying, you can have that meeting if you agree to a 5-year sunset clause. These things expire unless we agree to keep them going. That was a deal breaker, apparently. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's so it's just not how international trade agreements work. So, you know, we sign international trade agreements to create certainty about the rules of the game in the future. And NAFTA is a permanent treaty, right? There are ways to back out of it, but the idea is we have made this commitment, and that sets the rules of the game for the trade in the future. So we're talking about renegotiating NAFTA. The current NAFTA doesn't expire, right? The U.S. has a preference to renegotiate, but the current NAFTA is in place. So effectively what the U.S. is asking for is for the Canadians to say, we're going to replace the permanent NAFTA with a temporary NAFTA, and that creates massive uncertainty in international trade, because now not only will the current NAFTA not be in place, but we might have new rules. And after 5 years, the Trump administration or a future administration might walk away from this deal. You know, that's the exact opposite of what the purpose of these international negotiations are supposed to be, which is to update an existing treaty.
As we wrap up, there's talk of automotive tariffs now on various cars from various places. What happens when a car is assembled in Canada out of parts made in Mexico using specialty steel from the United States, or assembled in the United States with parts from other countries? Is that a foreign car?
It's very difficult, right? And there are international trade lawyers who make lots of money trying to disentangle these things. But in that specific example, the car is a NAFTA car, right? So it should be tariff-free, being within the free trade zone of North America. The more difficult cases are, say, like, you know, German automobiles. So some of them are now made, right, Mercedes and BMW are making cars down in, I believe, Tennessee and Alabama. Those are effectively American cars because they're produced here and sold here. But some of the cars are produced in the EU and then they're brought over. And so when we think about auto tariffs, right, what you're really talking about is Japanese cars that are exported from Japan to the United States, or German cars that are coming from Germany into the United States. But it's a difficult question, right? What is an American corporation? What is an American good? That's the problem with these global value changes. Corporations these days are producing and sourcing from all over the world. And the Trump administration's obsession with bilateral deficits doesn't really fit the way the global economy works today.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about the new steel and aluminum tariffs targeting Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. The early 1960s were a tumultuous time in the U.S. There had been efforts to desegregate many different types of public spaces. In May 1961, the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, decided it was time to challenge segregation on interstate buses. The Freedom Riders risked their lives and changed the course of American history. A new book profiles some of the Freedom Riders through personal interviews, including one man from Wisconsin. B.J. Hollers is an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's the author of several books on the history of race relations in the U.S. His most recent is The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. He joins us now from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. B.J., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
B.J., in hindsight, the Freedom Ride has become this legendary moment in American history. Take us back to just before it happened. It was this risky, daring, uncertain outcome event.
Absolutely. You know, basically what happened was in the summer of 1961, a group of folks, black, white, young, old, northern and southern, got together on these interstate buses to test a few Supreme Court rulings. And they were met with bombs and beatings and even imprisonment along the way.
And the buses themselves, federal law, federal courts had integrated them officially. You weren't supposed to be able to enforce segregation laws at the local level on interstate buses. That wasn't happening, though. Segregation was still a reality.
That's exactly it. The key is interstate buses. And so the 1946 Morgan versus Virginia ruling made it very clear that this was unconstitutional. And then later, the 1960 ruling, Boynton versus Virginia, went even further to say the bus terminals, too, couldn't be segregated. And so the Freedom Riders really set out to test both of these rulings to see if local law enforcement would do their jobs.
And BJ, before we pick up their story, what led you to follow their path and ultimately to try to find and interview some of those Freedom Riders?
You know, I was having dinner with a friend here in Eau Claire one night, and he said to me, have you heard of Jim's work? And so I kind of went through my mental Rolodex trying to figure out if I did know Jim's work. It sounded very familiar. And then when he said, you know, the Freedom Rider, it all came into sharp focus. A lot of folks may know Jim's work's picture, even if you don't know his name. He was a tall white man from Appleton, Wisconsin, whose picture was on the front page of many national newspapers in May of 1961 after being beaten in Montgomery. And so here were Wisconsin folks sitting down for breakfast, looking up at the newspaper and realizing, hey, a neighbor, a friend, someone from down the street, he's involved in this too, and maybe we should all take notice.
Let's follow Jim's story a little bit. From Appleton, as you said, a student at Beloit College, he shows up at school to meet his roommates.
That's correct. And one of his roommates is a guy named Bob Carter, who happened to be African-American. And so Jim and Bob became friends. They played basketball together. They walked around town together. And as their relationship grew, Jim began to realize that his friend wasn't being treated equally. And he couldn't quite get a handle on why that was. And so Bob introduced him to Martin Luther King's work, and Jim became very invested in the civil rights movement, so much so that he actually went to Fisk University and did an exchange program there, which is when he got involved in the movement.
And talk about how he got involved in that movement. What steps led along the way there?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of one thing led to another. So he was first in Nashville and noticing this group of folks picketing a movie theater. And that was curious to them. He'd never seen that before. So he went up to the man at the back of the line and asked him, you know, what are you guys doing? Turned out that man was a future seatmate of his on the Freedom Rides, John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis. And so he befriended John Lewis and began to integrate the movie theaters alongside these folks, and then shortly after grew into becoming a Freedom Rider himself.
Talking to BJ Hollers from UW Eau Claire, his new book is The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. He shares stories of people involved in the Freedom Ride, including one participant from Wisconsin. We're keying in on his story now, Jim Zwerg from Appleton originally. BJ, again, looking at it in hindsight, often it seems like the story is told that there is this protest movement, America United behind it. There are just a few bad guys pushing back against it. In reality, somebody like Jim faced a lot of pushback from his own family back here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And that's kind of an overlooked part of the civil rights movement generally, is kind of how families were sometimes divided as a result of the actions of one family member. And so while the Zwerg family was actually very progressive, they lived in Appleton. His father was a dentist and did quite a bit of free dental work to help folks and that sort of thing. When it came to putting their son's life on the line, to having their son call them up 3 days before leaving and saying, I'm getting on this bus, I may not come back, but I need to do it, that really tore the family apart a bit. His father had just had a heart attack. His mother, the last thing she said to him before hanging up the phone that night was, you're going to kill your father. And it wasn't the send-off that Jim's work helped for or hoped for, to save the least, but it reaffirmed for him the importance of what he was doing.
And you mentioned a life on the line. We know a lot of people were attacked, met with bombs and assault, as you mentioned. And in that theater protest, Jim and one of his companions walked into the theater and were knocked unconscious, a hit from behind. That was their first experience with violence, not their
last. That's exactly right. That was Jim's introduction to violence, and of course it wouldn't be the last time he faced it. Jim often talks about kind of the way Klansmen would attack, and oftentimes the white male was the primary target because he was a traitor to the race. And so Jim very much got the brunt of the violence right alongside John Lewis, right alongside so many others on May 20th in Montgomery there. But again, it was his photograph, this white college-age kid in suit and tie, blood dripping down from his face, that really, I think, woke white America up.
And you mentioned years later, Jim Zwerg talked about being at an event, looking back, commemorating the Freedom Ride, and seeing that picture, that famous picture of him.
Absolutely. And he had this moment because as a result of his injuries, he wasn't able to continue the ride himself. And one of his fellow Freedom Riders said, Jim, you were with us the whole way. You inspired us to keep going. And so it was a very moving moment for him. And he got pretty emotional about that.
I focused for most of our talk here on this Wisconsin participant you profile. But can you talk about some of the common experiences of all the people you talk to get their stories about the Freedom Rides?
Absolutely. You know, one thing that really stands out is this incredible humility. You know, one of the Freedom Riders, a guy named Charles Person, according to his wife, he didn't even mention the fact that he was a Freedom Rider until about 15 years into their marriage. You know, that's how modest these folks were. But one thing they really taught me, too, is that anyone can be a hero. You know, you aren't born a hero. You become a hero by performing heroic acts. And so these were ordinary folks who felt strongly and were willing to put their lives on the line. And I think that's why it's such an important story today.
Is it an important story to tell today and to follow as you did the Freedom Riders Trail? You ultimately talked to them. Why is it important in 2018 to be talking about the Freedom Riders?
That's a great question. That was sort of my primary aim. I didn't want to get the stories of what happened in the past and just leave it at that. I really wanted to ask them, where are we now? What can we do today? And I think the best example of this comes from a question that Freedom Rider Charles Person asked me, asked my students, asks a lot of folks. And it's a question that I ask folks when I talk to them during the readings. And his question is simply, what would you get on the bus for? And that question, of course, is really about what do you care about so deeply that you'd be willing to risk your life? And I think perhaps now more than ever, we have to think about that question on really pragmatic terms.
As we wrap up, do you think we're forgetting the stories of the Freedom Riders and the lessons we can learn from them?
You know, I sure hope not. Many Freedom Riders were a bit nervous about that very question. They said they worked so hard on the day-to-day fight for civil rights that they are afraid that their legacy might not inspire the next generation. And so I'm doing my very small part to make sure their voices can be heard and hopefully can do that inspirational work that they've certainly done for me.
BJ, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's BJ Hollers, Associate Professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. He joined us from our studios in Eau Claire. First, are you planning on grilling out this weekend? Might be easy to go with what's familiar, your trusty grill, some burgers, maybe brats. But on this edition of Food Friday, why not add a few new tricks? Our next guest has a whole bunch of advice for us. Different grilling methods, different kinds of fuel, cool grilling gear, and recipes, lots and lots of recipes. Barbecue Hall of Famer Stephen Reichlin has simplified the process with 7 steps to grilling nirvana. He's the author of the Barbecue Bible Cookbook Series, which includes the new book Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from the caveman porterhouse to salt slab brownie s'mores. He's also the host of several public TV shows, including the new one Project Fire. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, when it comes to grilling, we've got our gas grill at home, maybe our charcoal grill. We love our brats here in Wisconsin. But you say even after years and years of grilling yourself, you are still finding new secrets, new ideas out there.
Well, the whole idea of Project Fire was really to look at grilling today and where I think grilling will go tomorrow. Because as you pointed out rightly, you know, we all tend to grill the same 4 or 5 dishes over and over.
Guilty.
This is an opportunity to really broaden your horizons.
And you've got, as we said, 7 steps to grilling nirvana. And the first one is finding the right grill for us. So what's the best way to go out there on the market and pick that grill that's going to meet our needs?
Well, first of all, you need to think about whether you like the process of grilling, building a fire, et cetera, in which case you'd probably be more interested in a wood or wood-burning grill or a charcoal-burning grill. If, on the other hand, you're more convenience-oriented, you know, you just want to get to the destination, you'll probably enjoy grilling over gas more. Another factor is how much space you have. You know, if you have a small terrace, you know, that'll suggest a grill with a small footprint. How many people you typically grill for? You know, if it's just you and another person, a hibachi might be a great option. If you tend to grill for a lot of people, you know, you might want to get a stainless steel gas super grill.
And I want to dig into that charcoal or wood option. You offer me some new ways to cook stuff. I usually just do what's called the direct method, I guess. I put it on the grate over the heat. I might do a little indirect. It's even in the title, caveman style, caveman technique, where we're cooking the stuff right on the coals. Talk about that a little.
Oh, this is my favorite method, and you'll find this method throughout the book. Basically, it's grilling without a grill grate. You build a hot bed of coals. You might lay a porterhouse steak on the bed of coals, like you'll see on the cover shot, or you might grill the vegetables for salsa, your tomatoes, your peppers, your onions, directly on the coals, give them a smoky char, and then make a salsa. You can grill lobster this way. You can grill cabbage this way. It's one of my favorite. And, you know, in one sense, it's the world's oldest method of grilling. But in another sense, it's kind of new. But this is stepping out of the box with grilling.
What does that do? What's different in the outcome, the flavors that we don't get when we just slap it on top of the grill?
Well, first of all, from a texture point of view, you get a crust quite unlike any other. From a flavor point of view, you get a smoke flavor, a micro-charring that is quite unlike using a grill in a conventional manner. And then finally, and let's not underestimate this, you know, there's the sense of drama, the theatrics, because grilling is the world's most theatrical method of cooking, right? Nobody gathers around a stove to watch a pot of soup boil. But the minute you fire up the grill, you are on stage, and your guests become your audience.
Tell us a little more about that Caveman Porterhouse. We've got this recipe, by the way, Caveman Porterhouse with Pepper Hash, on the Ideas Network Facebook page and WPR.org/Food Friday. Talk us through this porterhouse.
Well, the porterhouse steak is seasoned quite simply with salt and pepper. The fireworks come from the method. And the method, as I said, you build a charcoal fire, you rake out the coals, you fan them with a newspaper to dislodge any loose ash, and then you lay the steaks right on the embers. I guarantee you, when people watch you do that the first time, they're going to flip. It's a quick char on both sides. Then while the steak is resting, because you always want to breast steak before you serve it, you know, that kind of hot off the grill is a big myth. You always want to let meat rest a little bit. In a skillet, you place olive oil, red peppers, yellow bell peppers, poblano chilies, garlic, chopped parsley. And you do kind of a quick pan fry, very colorful, very aromatic, and that gets poured over the steak. And so that kind of serves as a sauce and a vegetable at the same time. It just takes the flavor of your steak from, you know, takes it into the stratosphere.
Talking to Stephen Reichlin on this edition of Food Friday. His new book is Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from the Caveman Porterhouse to Salt Slab Brownie S'mores. Let's talk about that. This is one thing I never heard of before your book, Stephen. The Salt Slab. What's that?
Well, this is an example of sort of what I call future grilling. So Salt Slab started turning up on grills kind of in the last year or so. There is a salt mountain in the Himalayas of Pakistan, and it's known to great antiquity. Alexander the Great passed by, and, you know, watered and salted his horses on the way to India. But this mountain now is cut into bricks and slabs. You place a salt slab on your grill, you heat it up, and you can grill on the salt slab. And this is great for grilling fish because it won't stick to the grill grate. It's great for grilling vegetables. This is a dessert I actually created where it's kind of a modernist riff on the old-fashioned s'more. Instead of using graham crackers, you use super premium chocolate brownies. Instead of a cheap old candy bar, you use the best dark chocolate you can find. There's shredded mint for flavor. There's Grand Marnier for flavor. And then for marshmallows, I recommend using square artisanal marshmallows, which you can buy online or from a local pastry shop. And it's cooked on the salt slab. So you know how people love to add a pinch of salt, you know, salt caramel, you're probably familiar with.
Sure.
The salt tends to bring out the brownie sweetness. Plus, the presentation is just off the charts.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture right now. The brownies look fantastic. And I got to say, the salt slab itself looks really cool, too.
Yeah, right.
And it actually...
And by the way, you can reuse these salt slabs. You know, you scrape them off with a putty knife. And then the important thing is when the salt slab cools, put it in a resealable plastic bag, and that protects it from moisture, which would cause the salt to dissolve.
All right, another weird thing I came across in the book, Stephen, you like to grill...
Unusual. It's unusual.
Yep. I'm not saying weird in a judgmental way. Eggs.
Good.
Actually, I do have a judgment. It looks great in the picture. You have a awesome grilled eggs recipe. Now, you're not just slapping those right on the grate or even into the charcoal. We're doing the indirect method there, kind of.
No, but, boy, you just gave me an idea. Next time I fire my grill, I'm going to try to roast some eggs in the shell. No, this actually... You know, the first chapter of the book, Project Fire, I think sets the tone for the book, because my first chapter is on breakfast on the grill. And breakfast is not a meal we normally think of grilling. So right from the outset, I wanted to show you this is not your everyday grilling. But grilled eggs, they go into a skillet. They're topped with cheese. They're chopped, grated Parmesan cheese. They're chopped with heavy cream breadcrumbs. And then we make bacon by brushing prosciutto ham with oil and direct grilling it. So that gets crumbled on top. And the skillet goes on a grill set up for indirect grilling. You tossed a handful of wood chips on the coals to generate wood smoke. So you're simultaneously, you're roasting your eggs, you're smoking your eggs, you've got grilled prosciutto bacon. I mean, it's super easy, it's super quick, but it's the flavors are just off the chart delicious. By the way, that's a dish where if you came to my house early in the morning, we make that at least once a week at home.
I'll show up, no problem. Now, you mentioned wood there, Stephen. Can we add wood flavor even if we're not cooking just with wood? What's the best way to do that in charcoal? Can we get wood flavor on our gas grill?
The answer is affirmative to both. So the best trick in the book, I mean, it's just revolutionary, is you know that chimney starter that people use for lighting charcoal?
Yeah, I use one of those. It's great. I love it.
Okay. Well, instead of putting charcoal on your chimney starter, you can buy wood chunks at a hardware store that we use normally for smoking. You can light them in the chimney starter the way you would light charcoal, and you can be grilling over wood. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. Alternatively, you build a charcoal fire. You toss wood chunks or chips on the coals right before you put the food on. That's another way to get a great wood flavor. Even on a gas grill, what you can do is you lift up the grate, and usually there are those V-shaped flavorizer bars under the grate, you know. You nestle chunks of wood, hardwood, like pecan, hickory, cherry, apple, between those flavorizer bars over the grate. Food goes on top. You get an amazing smoke flavor.
And there's a debate, evidently, on wood to soak or not to soak. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I soak wood chips if I'm looking for a long smoke. Let's say if I'm preparing ribs or chicken and I want to get a smoke flavor. Soaking slows down the rate of combustion. However, if I'm looking to generate a huge amount of fragrant smoke in a very short time, like let's say if you want to smoke ice cream or smoke whipped cream, then I put the chips on unsoaked.
It's Food Friday, and Barbecue Hall of Famer Stephen Reichlin is with us. He's the author of the new book, Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from caveman porterhouse to salt slab brownie s'mores. He's the host of the new public television show, Project Fire. Check your local listings. I know at least some of the stations around Wisconsin are airing this, including Wisconsin Public Television. We want to hear from you aspiring grill masters now at 800-642-1234. Do you have some secret advice to share, your favorite grilling dish, or do you need some advice for Stephen? I'm guessing he's got an answer to your question, whatever it is related to grilling. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Check out that caveman porterhouse recipe on the Ideas Network Facebook page and WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Food Friday. We're grilling with Stephen Reichlin, author of the new cookbook, Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from the caveman porterhouse to salt slab brownie s'mores. He's the host of the public TV show Project Fire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of grill do you have? Are you broadening your horizons? What's the coolest, most out there thing you've grilled successfully? And do you have a question for Stephen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hey, thanks. And Stephen, thank you very much. First of all, I just wanted to
hi, Bill.
To you. I really appreciate the fact that you get your entire crew involved, and you show behind the camera, and you show how actually big a production your show is. I really commend you for that.
You know, I'm so glad you say that, because a lot of times you watch cooking shows and you think it's just one guy up there on the set, and man, ours takes a village.
Yeah, well, I do appreciate that. I have just a little, you know, Weber kettle, and I like to do pizza, but I'm trying to get the crust nice and crunchy without burning, And do you just have any tips about pizza on a Weber kettle grill? Thanks.
Well, I do, absolutely. So first of all, you probably know if you've watched my show, when I grill pizza, I actually drape the dough right on the grill grate. I don't use a pizza stone. Pizza stone is the safer way to do it. If you don't have a pizza stone, you can just use an inverted skillet, and that'll kind of give you a hot surface to warm the pizza. But to me, it's really interesting. When you take your dough, you brush it with oil on both sides, you lay it right on the grill grate, and the dough sort of puffs up and gets crackly and crisp. The secret, Bill, is to have one zone medium high and one zone with no fire at all, safety zone. So as you're cooking the dough, if it starts to burn or you need to get a little breathing space, you move it to the cold-free safety zone.
All right, good luck. Hope that helps. Let's go now to Scott on the line in Windsor. Scott, hi.
Hey, I love the show. I look forward to this every Friday.
Hey, thanks a lot.
I just want to suggest one of the things that's revolutionized my grilling experience, and that is
okay.
Preparation of the meat. Steaks work especially well with a sous vide cooking system. It's basically a controlled temperature water bath that you can set to within a tenth of a degree if you buy it by the right unit. And you can bring your steaks, for instance, to 132 degrees, perfectly, you know, rare or whatever temperature you prefer. And then you prepare the coals or the grill, and all you're looking to do there is to give it a nice sear, and that's called a Maillard reaction. You probably know all of this, but too many people don't, but it takes all the prep time and a lot of the guesswork out of doing meats right on the grill.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. So, Stephen, he's basically mostly pre-cooking the meat and then getting that sear on it sounds like, on the grill. What do you think of that?
Well, I will be honest. You know, first of all, my bottom line with grilling is if whatever you're doing works and people love it and you love it, you're doing it right. I'm personally am not a big sous vide advocate. I kind of like the more primal experience of cooking a meat from start to finish over the fire. I think there's a certain vigor, a certain robustness, even a certain violence that comes with cooking that way. But many people use the sous vide method, including the modernist cuisine visionary Nathan Myhrvold. So, you know, think about it. I certainly appreciate the caller reminding us that it exists.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Stephen Reichlin. His new book is Project Fire. We are talking about grilling. Back to your calls now. Tony is on the line in Waukesha. Tony, hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
Great. How about you?
Yeah, what a timely topic. So I've been experimenting a lot with the, you know, trying to take my grill game up a little, doing the low and slow methods for, you know, picnic shoulders and ribs and such. In the past, I've been kind of a just throw it on direct and wish for the best. What I've noticed is that I've been having trouble with the low temperatures that we use for doing those, 275 to 350. I'm not getting my like hickory chips or the wood to start smoldering to create the smoke.
Okay, so first of all, what kind of grill are you using?
Well, I've been using the gas one a lot. I have a nice lever. I also have a charcoal, but I've been trying to do a lot of these on the gas because, you know, when you're grilling something low like that for 6 hours, it's just a lot easier to maintain temperature.
Okay, well, there's your problem because most gas grills are really not designed to cook at lower temperatures. And I would urge you, if you really want to go the low and slow method, I would urge you to kind of focus more on your charcoal grill. Now, there is a technique you can use that's called a top-down burn, where if you're trying to indirect grill on a kettle grill, you mound your coals up on one side, and then you put like a quarter of a chimney's worth of coals on top of those unlit coals and put your food on the other side. Let the coals burn down gradually. I typically do this in a Weber Smoky Mountain smoker, which kind of looks like an upright, well, it's called the bullet sometimes. And with the top-down method and that, you can get a burn of, you know, sort of 5-6 hours with no sweat because, again, the hot coals on top are burning downwards. On a kettle grill, it's going to be a little bit less, I suspect, but nonetheless, it will work on a kettle. Gas grill, I've just had the hardest time, you know, keeping a gas grill at 250, 275.
All right, Tony, good luck. Hope that helps. Steven, I'm going to put you on the spot. You're talking to Wisconsin here. This next question will risk making you enemies. What is your advice for grilling brats?
Okay, I'm a Yankee and an iconoclast, so I'm probably going to make a lot of enemies, but I do cook brats. I love your brats, and I have a very singular method for doing it. So you all usually cook your brats direct grilled. I like to set the grill up for indirect grill. I like to work on a charcoal grill. That means the fire, the mounds of lit coals on the periphery at the sides, and then the brats lined up in the center. What I do is I add a handful of hardwood hickory or oak chokes or a couple of wood chunks, close the grill lid, and I indirect grill the brats at about 375 degrees for about a half an hour. Now, three things happen when you do that. One, the wood chips give your brats a smoke flavor. Two, your brats will never burst like often happens with direct grilling, so they're incredibly moist and succulent. And three, it's virtually set it and forget it. I mean, you don't have to worry about turning the brats, the brats cooking at uneven rate, splitting. It's absolutely fail-proof. And I know many of your listeners probably want to ride me out of Wisconsin or burn me at the stake. But if you try it, I promise you they'll be the best brats you've ever tasted.
And finally, and we have arguments within Wisconsin, so don't worry too much, Stephen.
Okay.
You have some.
I say that tongue in cheek because I have done my that method many times in Wisconsin when I've been on book tour, and people always enjoy it.
And now you've got a chapter, desserts and drinks. How do we grill a
Correct.
Drink?
Well, perfect drink for coming summertime, sangria, the Spanish fruit and wine punch. So what I do is I cut all the fruit, the lemons, the oranges, the limes, in half, dip them in sugar, and char them on a hot grill grate, which turns the sugar and fruit juices into caramel, gives you a smoky flavor. That fruit then gets diced, put in a bowl with brown sugar, rum, and cinnamon, and it makes sort of a very rich, fruity, caramelly, smoky base. Then if I want to make a red sangria, I add Lambrusco, which is an Italian sparkling red wine. If I want to make a white sangria, I add Prosecco, which is an Italian sparkling white wine. I promise you it will be the best, the most remarkable, the most unforgettable sangria you've ever tasted.
Stephen, we just have a few moments left for us vanilla grillers. I'll admit I do the same thing and again, give us a quick pep talk to get us to try something new and fun.
Well, I mean, first of all, buy Project Fire. Watch the Project Fire TV show on your local public television. Try something new. I'll tell you what, that caveman T-bone that's on the cover of the book, that is a game changer. And if you're a charcoal griller out there and you try this just once, you'll be amazed, you'll be proud, you'll be satisfied, and you will dazzle the people that have gathered at your barbecue.
Steven, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been fun for me, too. Thanks a lot.
That's Steven Reichlin, author of a whole lot of cookbooks, including the one we've been talking about, Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from the caveman porterhouse to salt slab brownie s'mores. He's the host of a lot of public TV shows over the years, including Project Fire. We have that recipe for the caveman porterhouse. You can find that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Also, look that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Check it out there. Try it out and run through the archives, too. There's a lot of recipes there. We talked about board games yesterday on the show, and you've been sharing more of your favorites online. Here are some of your suggestions. Michael suggests Ticket to Ride. That came up on the show yesterday. He recommends the Europe or version, America version, or Asian version, and Eric seconded that selection. Justin says a King Domino or King Domino. I have that game. I don't know how to pronounce it. King Domino, we'll call it, is a quick, easy-to-learn game, and David backs him up. I love King Domino, perfect for a family with younger children. It's a quick, pretty easy-to-learn game. Jamie says Above and Below. Beautiful artwork and deep and detailed world. We love playing and watching the story unfold. I just learned how to play that one out visiting my brother over the last few days. Amber suggests Gloomhaven. I can't get enough, Amber says. Eric recommends Arkham Horror, a cooperative game based on the writings of H.P. Lovecraft. I've played that a time or 20. Megan recommends Cribbage. That's a great card game. You need your Cribbage board. Do you call it a board? Yeah, I don't know if you can grill on that, though. But Cribbage is a great game. 15-2, 15-4, ain't no more. John recommends Cards Against Humanity. That's one I have not played myself. Gerald says there's no wrong board game. He recommends Seven Wonders Duel, Unlock, and Rising Sun. Jerry recommends Castles of Burgundy, and plus a whole bunch more. And Melinda recommends Forbidden Island. That's another cooperative one. Keep sharing yours. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.